Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling something pretty intense but really important. What actually happens in those first absolutely critical 48 hours when a labor strike hits a company? We want to cut through the noise for you.
Yeah, and it's fascinating because, you know, people think about the big picture, the negotiations, but it's often a small slip up in those first 2 days, maybe a poorly handled security issue with incoming staff or just bad internal communication that can completely derail everything. It turns a manageable situation into, well, massive crisis, sometimes costing millions for places like hospitals, manufacturing plants, anywhere with a critical workforce. This isn't just planning. It's really about survival.
Survival strategy. That's a powerful way to put it. Okay, so our mission today for you listening is to really unpack what a good response looks like. We want to give you that roadmap for employers during this super intense window. How do they keep things stable, keep operating, and crucially, how do they control the story? All right, let's set the scene a bit. I mean, it's not just speculation anymore, is it? Labor strikes seem to be more common. We're seeing more union activity, tight labor markets. It feels like a much more challenging landscape for businesses right now.
Oh, absolutely. It's a definite trend. And the cost, if you're not ready, it's honestly staggering. Think about a big auto plant. If they shut down completely, some estimates are up to like $50 million a day.
50 million.
Per day.
Yeah.
It's a number that gets boardroom attention fast. But it's not just the money, right? You've got huge safety risks with understaffing, hazards for the workers still there, and sometimes for the public too. Customers feel it immediately. Missed deadlines, canceled services, that trust erodes so quickly. And then there's the brand damage. Bad headlines stick around.
Okay, so that $50 million figure really puts it in perspective. So the takeaway seems to be the companies that handle this well, they don't just sit back and hope. They treat those first 48 hours like a mission, almost military-like precision.
Exactly. It's a stabilization mission. Mobilize fast, get resources in place, and send a clear message. We're resilient. We're managing this. It's about projecting control, not chaos.
Okay, so how do they actually do that? When everything's hitting the fan, the clock's ticking. Let's dive into maybe the key steps. You mentioned five. What are those first moves?
Right. So the very first move, interestingly, isn't about operations yet. It's organizational. Step one, activate the strike response team immediately. This means having a designated leader, someone clearly in charge, backed up by heads of HR, legal, security, operations. Everyone knows their role.
Clarity from the top.
Precisely. And defining those roles instantly. Then, clear, calm communication internally to the non-striking staff. Where do they report? Who's their contact? What should they expect? Speed and consistency are everything here. Avoid that internal confusion spiral.
Makes total sense. Without that clear command structure, everything else probably just crumbles. So, okay, team activated. What's next? Keeping the lights on, right?
Yeah.
The workforce must be priority number one.
Absolutely. That's step two. Secure workforce continuity. This is where the planning really pays off. Usually this involves engaging a strike staffing partner you've already lined up. These are specialized agencies.
The ones with pools of workers ready to go.
Exactly. Nationwide pools, often. They provide what are called contingent workers.
Temporary staff, basically.
Right. Temporary, but often skilled, staff brought in just for the strike. The key is getting them to the most critical roles first. Then it's rapid onboarding. Think condensed orientation safety essentials, core job functions. Get them working safely, quickly. And sometimes you can cross-train internal staff from less critical areas to help out.
So the goal isn't perfection, it's continuity. Just keeping essential things running.
That's it, exactly. Continuity, not perfection. Fill the gaps, maintain vital services.
Okay, but bringing in new people, tensions are high, everything's in flux. I imagine safety risks just shoot through the roof. How do you manage that? How do you make sure safety isn't, you know, another casualty in those first couple of days?
Excellent point. And that leads straight to step three. Maintain operational safety. This is non-negotiable. You need brief, really targeted training, refreshers on equipment, PPE, personal protective equipment, hazard awareness. Even a quick 10-minute session can make a huge difference. We've seen it prevent major incidents.
Like avoiding an accident that could just escalate the whole thing.
Precisely. A preventable accident on day one is a nightmare. You also assign safety observers, often supervisors, to actively monitor risks in real time. And of course, physical security. Heightened measures for staff, facilities, and those incoming replacement workers. Protecting everyone is key. Preventing safety setbacks is crucial because they just compound the disruption.
Right. And you mentioned communication earlier. In those first 48 hours, I guess silence is the enemy. It just breeds uncertainty. So step four is communicate with stakeholders.
Exactly. You need a clear, two-pronged approach here. internally. Brief your managers, give them consistent talking points, reassure the employees who are still working, tell them what's happening, what the plan is.
Keep everyone on the same page.
Yes. And then externally, notify customers about potential impacts, but, and this is key, emphasize the contingency plans you have in place. Show you're prepared. Update suppliers, partners too. Maintain that confidence. The goal is really to control the narrative. Show resilience, be transparent, don't let rumors fill the vacuum.
Okay, controlling the narrative. Makes sense. And the last step, step five. You said strike staffing isn't static, it has to be dynamic.
Absolutely. You can't just deploy workers and assume it's done. Step five is monitor and adjust staffing levels. This means real-time assessment. Are people showing up? How's productivity? Where are the gaps emerging?
So you're constantly evaluating.
Constantly. And then reallocating those replacement workers to where they're needed most could be a specific production line, could be an ER ward in a hospital. Fixing those critical bottlenecks. You need to stay flexible, ready to scale up or down depending on how the strike is evolving. It's this real-time adaptability that keeps operations stable long-term, prevents things from drifting.
Wow, okay. That is a lot to manage in just 48 hours. That's incredibly complex. From what you've seen, what really separates the companies that pull this off smoothly from those that just flounder? What's the secret sauce?
It's funny. Sometimes it's not the big strategic things they miss. It's the small stuff. Like, did they actually arrange enough hotel rooms for the replacement staff? Is their food ready? Security details. If those basics aren't locked down, the whole plan can fall apart surprisingly fast. So the single biggest factor, almost always, is advanced preparation.
It all comes back to planning.
Every time. You absolutely cannot improvise this effectively. You need those pre-negotiated staffing agreements ready to activate within, say, 24 hours. You need detailed contingency protocols covering all the logistics, housing, food, transport, training sites. And crucially, you need to have tested it. Tabletop exercises, simulations, practice before the real thing hits. Without that prep, you're playing catch up from minute one.
The devil's in the details, like housing and food. Okay. Let's get really granular then. Paint a picture for us. Let's say I'm running Apex Manufacturing. Strike hits. What does it feel like, hour by hour?
Okay, Apex Manufacturing, hours 1 to 12. It's all about stabilize and assess. First, confirm it's official. Strike start time, who's out, expected duration, get the facts. Immediately activate that predefined response team. Leadership, HR, ops, legal they meet, align priorities based on the plan.
Get everyone in the room, virtual or physical.
Right, call the staffing partner, tell them go. Those pre-agreed plans kick in. Mobilization starts. Simultaneously, secure the site. Control access points, protect sensitive areas, and make those calm internal announcements to non-striking staff. Here's the plan. Here's what you do. This phase sets the tone. Control, not panic. Okay, now we're moving into hours 12 to 24. Focus shifts to mobilize resources. At Apex, replacement workers start arriving. Maybe at the plant, maybe at a nearby staging area like a hotel. The staffing partner is handling their lodging, meals, transport, all those logistics that were pre-planned.
So you start seeing the reinforcements arrive.
Exactly. And they go straight into accelerated onboarding. Quick sessions on safety, their specific job, who they report to. Initial shift schedules are drawn up. You need that 24/7 coverage locked in. While this is happening, Apex's comms team sends out those external updates. Customers, suppliers, here's our plan, we're managing it. This phase is about visibly closing that workforce gap, showing you're plugging the holes. All right, final stretch, hours 24 to 48. Now Apex moves to operate and adapt. Supervisors are on the floor, closely watching how the replacement workers are doing. Are production targets being met? Where are the bottlenecks?
Fine-tuning the operation.
Exactly. Reallocating staff if needed. Maybe one line needs more support than initially planned. They're also extending contingency plans, preparing for this to last beyond 48 hours if needed. Leadership stays engaged with labor talks, of course. And everything is documented meticulously. What actions were taken, staffing levels, safety checks, critical for compliance and later analysis. By the end of hour 48, Apex Manufacturing should feel relatively stable, sustainable, even if the strike continues.
That hour-by-hour breakdown is incredibly helpful. It really brings it to life. Now, Apex was manufacturing, but how does this look different in other sectors? The core principles must apply, but the specifics change, right?
Absolutely. The context is everything. Take healthcare. For hospitals or clinics, the stakes are immediate patient safety. They need replacement nurses, techs, support staff who are fully credentialed, background checked, and ready to care for patients within hours. There's zero room for error with patient care and licensing.
Right. You can't just pull anyone off the street for an ER.
No way. Contrast that with manufacturing. The focus there might be keeping specific assembly lines running, operating complex machinery, maybe critical maintenance. The goal is avoiding those huge revenue losses and supply chain chaos. For logistics and warehousing, think big distribution centers or trucking companies, it's about keeping goods moving, getting drivers, warehouse workers, dispatchers in place quickly to prevent freight from piling up and deliveries being missed.
Everything grinds to a halt otherwise.
It does. And briefly, think about energy and utilities. A strike there could impact public safety, keeping power grids running, water treatment plants operational. They often need staff with specific OSHA certifications quickly. So each industry has its unique pressure points in those first 48 hours.
That makes sense. Given the urgency, the specialized skills, the logistics, let's talk cost. I mean, this sounds expensive. Is it the kind of cost that makes executives balk? Or is it seen as a necessary evil?
It's definitely a significant cost, no question. You're looking at several buckets. Premium wages, often for the replacement workers you're paying for their immediate availability and sometimes hardship conditions. Housing and meals, especially if they're brought in from out of state. Mm-hmm. Transportation flights, buses, the cost of that rapid condensed orientation. And definitely on-site security, which is often scaled up significantly.
So yeah, not cheap.
Not cheap. But, and this is the crucial calculation companies make, how does it compare to the alternative? Compare those upfront staffing costs to potentially millions per day in lost revenue, or huge penalties for missing contract deadlines, or the long-term cost of a damaged reputation. When you frame it that way, strike staffing becomes an investment in business continuity. It's often the far less expensive option in the long run.
An investment, not just an expense.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, under all this pressure, mistakes must happen. What are the big common blunders you see companies make in those crucial first 48 hours, the things to absolutely avoid?
Oh, there are definitely common pitfalls, and they can undo all the good planning. Number one is often delayed decision making, hesitating, waiting too long to call the staffing partner. Every hour counts. That delay can be crippling.
Analysis paralysis.
Exactly. Second, underestimating logistics, thinking you can figure out housing or food on the fly for hundreds of people, it never works. Workers need those basics secured immediately, or morale plummets and they might just leave. Third, ignoring safety. Trying to cut corners on safety training during onboarding to save time. Huge mistake. Creates massive liability and the risk of an incident shutting everything down anyway.
Penny wise, pound foolish.
You got it. Fourth, poor communication. Just going silent. Leaves everyone, employees, customers, media guessing. That allows rumors and negative narratives to take over. And finally, failing to scale or adapt. Thinking the initial deployment is enough. You have to keep monitoring and adjusting staffing as the situation evolves. Not doing that undermines the whole effort. Avoiding these is key to navigating the storm.
Those seem like critical lessons learned, probably the hard way for some companies. Now, you mentioned regional differences earlier. Strike dynamics aren't the same everywhere. Can you give us a couple of examples? How might priorities shift in different parts of the U.S.?
Sure. Location definitely matters due to dominant industries and, frankly, local labor relations history. Take California. It consistently sees a high number of strikes across many sectors. So in those first 48 hours, a major priority might be getting credentialed healthcare staff into LA or San Francisco hospitals fast. But you also have the massive ports like Long Beach. Securing logistics operations there is critical to prevent knock-on effects across the entire national supply chain. The scale there is immense.
So healthcare and logistics are huge pressure points.
Very much so. Now look at New York, also very strike-prone, big union presence. Again, healthcare is huge, mobilizing licensed staff for hospitals in NYC or maybe Buffalo. But you also have the critical public transit piece, like the MTA in New York City. Ensuring continuity there is vital because the city relies on it so heavily. Any stoppage has immediate, widespread impact due to population density.
Right. Millions rely on the MTA.
Exactly. And maybe one more, say Texas. You've got unique challenges there with the energy sector, huge logistics hubs, and growing healthcare needs. So priorities might involve rapid deployment of OSHA-certified staff for refineries in the energy sector, alongside healthcare staffing, while also focusing on keeping freight moving through major hubs like Dallas or Houston.
Different industries, different immediate needs.
Precisely. And think Michigan automotive is king. Stabilizing production lines in the Detroit area to prevent those national supply chain ripples is paramount, alongside healthcare needs. Each region has its own flavor based on its economic drivers.
This has been incredibly insightful. It really hammers home that nailing those first 48 hours isn't just about good planning, it's fundamental. It feels like it's about protecting the organization's core viability, its reputation, its survival, like you said at the start. It shows the real power of being prepared and acting decisively.
Absolutely. And I hope listeners take away that these steps, clear command, sorting logistics early, communicating well, staying flexible, aren't just theoretical. They are the practical building blocks for maintaining stability when everything feels like it's shaking. It's about holding the line operationally, even when the ground is shifting.
So here's a final thought for you to chew on as we wrap up. Thinking beyond the immediate crisis, how might a company's ability to handle these first 48 hours, well, demonstrating that resilience and competence under pressure, how might that shape its broader reputation? How does being seen as reliable during a crisis affect how customers and the public view them long after the strike is resolved? Something to consider. Until next time on The Deep Dive, keep digging deeper.